I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, City in a Forest. If you've ever flown into Atlanta, and that's about 100 million passengers a year, you've certainly noticed one thing as you soar over the city: the trees. Atlanta's urban canopy gives it an enduring nickname, City in a Forest, and towering pride, if not a plenty of pollen. These green guardians beautify our neighborhoods, clean our air, and cool our homes. But it takes a community to ensure they're around for all to enjoy. In honor of Earth Day, Arbor Day, and springtime in the Peach State, we thought it'd be fun to celebrate the season with a look back at our roots and the shade they provide. This month, we take a look at trees, with a few friends who help keep Atlanta green and the conversation colorful. My guests today are park protector and former board member of the Olmsted Linear Park Alliance, Jenny Richardson, Wayne Shannon, the tree cowboy, co-executive director of Trees Atlanta, Greg Levine, and the colorfully talented artist, Daniel Blaneau, whose exhibit, A Conversation with Trees, opens later this month.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. A tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth, sweet flowing breast. A tree that looks at God all day and lifts her leafy arms to pray.
I know exactly how I got involved. I was going to Georgia State, and I was working down there, and I rented a house. And one day, a man came by with leaflets and flyers and talked about this freeway. And I looked at the maps, and I realized that the house I was living in was in the road, in the middle of the road.
You were listening to Jenny Richardson, former board member of the Olmsted Linear Park Alliance.
At the point that I learned about the road, I had just bought the house. So I got involved in the road fight, which has been on the city, in the city plans or the DOT's plans, since about 1946. And back then it was called the Stone Mountain Tollway, and it was supposed to connect Stone Mountain, US 78, to the what we call the Boulevard Glen Iris Stub. It was going to connect those two ends with a freeway that went right through my neighborhood. And it just became a neighborhood obsession for about five or six neighborhoods to fight this road, and it took 30 years. We're one of the few neighborhoods or groups in the country that successfully fought a major four lane. It consumed my life. And how Olmsted figures into all of that is that one of the first plans of the road, they were going to run the expressway pretty much down the middle of the park, because it would be more cost effective.
Obviously, what was the condition of the, what year was this, and what was the condition of the Olmsted Linear Park at that time?
When I first moved over there, it was 1970, and there were a lot of absentee landlords. Everybody was getting out because there was going to be a freeway. The park was decrepit. It was a mess. In fact, I didn't walk in it because the grass was very, very high. There was glass, trash, tires, auto parts dumped there, broken bottles, cans. It was just not attractive. And the reason that it wasn't being taken care of is because it was not going to be there. What's the point of doing work on the park if there's going to be a four lane there? And so the Olmsted Park Society of Atlanta was formed in 1983, and we were not a nonprofit group because we wanted to do political things. And we had two agendas. One was to let people know that the park was indeed designed by Frederick Law Olmsted. It was his last residential project, and it was before he passed away, before he died, and his only project in the Deep South. The closest one to us is Biltmore Estate in Asheville.
And is that how he came to Atlanta, by working in Asheville?
He was at Asheville working for George Washington Vanderbilt, and he came down here at the request of Joel Hurt, who at that point was developing Druid Hills, which was called Kirkwood Land Company at that point.
And who also did Inman Park?
Joel Hurt did, right. Inman Park. And then later on, Joel Hurt, I guess he was brilliant, but he didn't have real good financial sense. And he went belly up with some of his investments and sold the Kirkwood Land Company to Asa Candler and some other rich guys in town, Candler of Coca-Cola. Fortunately for us, Asa Candler and his people agreed to continue on with the plan Olmsted had drawn for Hurt. So that's how we got the park. Olmsted came down here while he was at Biltmore working for Vanderbilt. He would make trips down to Atlanta and plan. This was in the 1890s. And then the definitive plan is the 1905 plan, which by this time Olmsted, he was either very ill or he had already died. And his firm, namely his son and stepson, finished the plan to his specifications.
And when did the park, let's call it officially, open?
Well, it would have been... It was being built as the first houses in Druid Hills were being built, and the first one, I think, is 1904. And the park was considered to be the centerpiece, something to draw these people in to buy the homes and live in this residential suburb close to Atlanta but filled with green spaces. And Olmsted laid out not just the park, but he laid out most of the early parts of Druid Hills, most of the early roads.
In those days when this area would have been heavily wooded, did Olmsted come in and through design plant trees or work around what was there?
Well, that's a wonderful question, but to correct you, it probably wasn't heavily wooded because it had been pretty much destroyed during the Civil War.
This would not be the first time I've been corrected on this show.
Well, you know, during the Civil War, there was fighting there. Union soldiers camped on what is today the golf course of Druid Hills Golf Course. And right over near the Candler Park MARTA station was where James McPherson, who was a Union, he might have been a general, I think he was. He was sitting there eating lunch when he heard the first shots at the Battle of Atlanta. So in addition to the Civil War, you had farmland. So it was pretty ragged land. Well, what Olmsted did, he had a vision. He's considered the father of landscape architecture, the first person to really think about topography, and he looked at the lay of the land, and instead of saying, let's just cut a straight shot through and bulldoze everything out of the way, which we do now, let's follow the contour lines.
We've come a long way.
We have. I mean, if you look at Ponce de Leon Avenue from town out to where the park starts, you see a straight line, and you see straight lines in a grid fashion out here in Atlanta, and that's what people did. Although back then they were doing it with like mules and plows and so forth. They didn't have the bulldozers that we have today. When you get to Druid Hills, you've got these curvilinear streets. They follow natural areas, sort of like the Appalachian Trail follows the ridgeline, and you're not up at the top of the mountain necessarily, but you're on the shoulder of the mountain. That's what Olmsted did. If you look at a topo map, you see exactly what he was up to. And he was all about views and vistas, and you're in a group of trees and you walk out and you can see this stretch of ground that goes forever, you think, but it's because the roads are concealed. And the way he did that was to lower the roadbeds of the cross streets so that when you come out and look at some of these parks, you don't see the streets going across. And I understand he did that in Central Park as well in New York.
So for a long period of time, maybe 60 plus years, the park had a nice, pleasant environment. And then in the 1970s, it starts to go into a serious decline.
I would say it was probably earlier than the 70s. And I'm not real sure about the early days. Olmsted conceived of the park to be for the public. But I think I'm right about this, that he expected the people that owned homes in Druid Hills to keep it up, and no one wanted to do that. Like your yard, green space needs attention. You've got to remove invasives. You've got to, well, the city cuts the grass and the county cuts the grass. You've got to keep the grass cut. You have to remove dead limbs, shrubs that die. things that are infected by insects and other diseases. A lot of dogwoods right now have something called anthracnose, and we had ambrosia beetles in some of the oaks in the park, and we had to have those cut. So if you don't take care of it, then it's going to look terrible.
And what's the, outside of the historical relevance, why else is it important to have this?
In the beginning, back in 82, is Sally Harbaugh, and she's now in her 80s. And she started the Olmsted Park Society, and she went to a Department of Transport meeting and held up a color replica of the Mona Lisa and then ripped it up. She ripped up the Mona Lisa and she said, "This is what you want to do. You want to destroy a work of art."
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, City in a Forest, brought to you by Perkins and Will.
In the shade of old apple tree.
Apple tree.
When the love in your eyes I could see.
I could see.
Mama, when the voice that I heard like a song of bird seemed to whisper sweet music to me.
Music to me.
I could hear the buzz of the bee.
Buzz of the bee.
In the blossom as you said to me.
Said to me.
Mama, with a heart that is true, I'll be waiting for you.
Yes, shade of the old apple tree.
My name is Greg Levine. I'm the co-executive director of Trees Atlanta and also the chief program officer. And Trees Atlanta is a nonprofit organization that plants, protects, and educates people about the importance of trees.
Let's tell people about what Trees Atlanta really does and what you all have done and what it, you know, what it means to the city.
Well, Trees Atlanta has been around since 1985, and we've planted nearly 100,000 trees since that first project in downtown Atlanta. And we were created by the Parks Department, Junior League, and CAP, Central Atlanta Progress. And it was really created just to beautify downtown at the time, make it more walkable, a little bit more livable for the few residents that live there. And it's developed into much more than that. So we're doing everything we can. The forest restoration is truly a forest that is an urban forest that often you have plants like kudzu and Chinese privet taking over the actual ground floor so thick, and English ivy, which everyone loves, that new trees can't grow. And your shrub layer can't grow, and that perennial layer can't grow. So you're simplifying that that ecosystem into very few plants, which can only support so many species. But I think also a little bit of a legacy. Now when you do developments, there's a better tree ordinance. More trees are protected. More trees have to be replanted. And that was not the case when the organization started. So much more has happened just because of the organization's existence.
You've planted a lot personally, haven't you?
Sure, but I stopped counting.
So 100,000 trees, and it sounds like a lot.
Yeah,
but when you're in 90,000 acres, like, can you see a difference with 100,000 trees?
I think you do see a difference because we are very strategic on where we plant them. We plant them in our parks. We plant them in the right-of-way. That's the area between the sidewalk and the curb. We try to plant them in parking lots when we can. We plant them in corridors, major corridors that go through the city, major neighborhood streets. So we really are focused on where visually more people can enjoy them. I mean, it makes Atlanta and Georgia a very special place. We do have one of the most diverse forests in the country, and it's something that we should be celebrating as a community, as people that hopefully love our state and city, that we're different than most places. You know, lacking the river right in the middle of the city and or in the mountains north of the city, Atlanta really has this wonderful living thing to celebrate.
Yeah, and there are different trees and different landscapes in the different neighborhoods of Atlanta. What type of trees do we have here? Like, name a handful.
I've been asked, how many trees can you name in 30 seconds? And it makes me work better.
All right, well, I'll give you 25 seconds.
25 seconds. See, there are 32. There are 31 native oaks to Georgia, Georgia oak, water oak, white oak, chinkapin oak, swamp chestnut oak, Water Oak, Willow Oak, Cherry Bark Oak, Southern Red Oak, Oglethorpe Oak. I'm still impressed with myself for a minute. So that's just a few oaks. You got Tupelo, you have three or four native hickories, Southern Magnolia, Big Leaf Magnolia, Umbrella Magnolia, Astraea, Musselwood, which is Carpinus in Latin. There's just a fantastic beech, one of my favorite trees, Yellowwood, Smoke Tree. There are over 200 native species to Georgia, if I remember correctly. And if you start getting to cultivars and varieties, you can get to hundreds and hundreds of trees. In fact, we've planted between species and cultivars on the Beltline project alone, I think we're like 70 cultivars and species just on that east side trail. If you go to the west side section of the Beltline, we have another probably 10 or 15 additional type. Getting people to stop and think about what we take for granted, I think that's what is... We still have major tree loss. We lose 50 acres a day still. You get in an airplane, people are like, oh, there's so many trees.
Where are we losing 50 acres a day?
In Metro Atlanta. In fact,
really?
In fact, we have three of the top 10 counties of tree loss in the entire east and southeast.
To development?
Yep. Gwinnett, I hope I don't get these wrong. Fulton and Cobb counties. I believe it's Cobb County. Three of the top 10 in the southeast counties of tree loss. There's no state with three counties. It's because we do have a beautiful, intact, just huge forest. We've done some great improvements in the way we do development. We still need to do more. It needs to include density, redevelopment of shopping centers that don't make sense or are no longer in existence. We should be redeveloping those before we go to a forest that has all these benefits, financial benefits, that we're starting to get measurements on that we're not valuing when we rip the trees out.
It's so amazing what trees can do.
Yeah, it's an instant change. That's why people like to volunteer with us, because not only do they plant the tree, but they go back and see it 10 years. And like my investment, I can see it's grown. It's not even in the bank. It's right there growing. So you see that huge tree. And that's why we get volunteers to stick around for 15, 20 years. We do have some of them been around that long.
Well, if you want to drive a big limousine, about the longest one you ever seen. The tall, tall trees and all the water in the seas, because I'm a fool, fool, fool for you. Well, if you want to own a great big mansion, yes, I'll give it my utmost attention. I'll buy you tall, tall trees and all the water in the seas, because I'm a fool, fool, fool for you. Yes, I'm a fool for you.
It may take a while, but I'll prove it's true.
Well, if it's loving you want, I've got it. And if it's money you want, I'll get it. I'll buy you tall, tall trees and all the waters in the seas, because I'm a fool, fool, fool for you.
Well, my name is Wayne Shannon, and I'm an arborist, a risk assessor, a tree climber.
People should know, like when you and I met, so I'll just tell the quick story. I had some trees that needed some limbs, I guess, taken down because they were potentially going to fall on a building.
Oh, yeah.
And I come outside and I see this guy, who happens to be you, like 50 feet in the air with a chainsaw. And you come down and we start talking and you're the tree cowboy. So I'm seeing this guy. I'm like, wow, that's scary, impressive, crazy. But when you're up there and you're in your work and you're in your zone, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking, man, who is this guy walking up under my tree? Actually, I think that sometimes, because you got to pay attention to everybody that's on the ground when you're up there. And so when I'm working with my crew, I'm like, hey, now when you hear my saw running, there's certain protocol that we follow. Okay, so, you know, like, don't walk in on me if I'm in the middle of a cut, because I can't read your mind. Even if I'm a foot away from you, I'm not going to read your mind, let alone 50 feet. I can't see anything that you might appear to be doing, you know. So in my mind, you don't know that I'm getting ready to do this particular thing. And, you know, we always want to have an escape route for maybe, let's say, a rope snaps or something doesn't work out quite right, or maybe there's a domino effect and something else gets hit and breaks, and then you got maybe a rotten limb that breaks into multiple pieces. That's kind of what I'm thinking about. And then, you know, you get a chance to look out at the skyline and enjoy the scenery a little bit in between, you know, get some fresh air. It's not easy work. but it can be very enjoyable.
Do you find like a certain peace being up there?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's, you know, this is an adventure right inside the city every day.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, City in a Forest.
I lean my back against you, thinking you were an oak. I knew the wind could bend you, but I can't believe you broke.
Now the wind could never break me, only your false love.
Honey, I've been true, I swear by God above.
I thought you were a willow, but you never wept for me. You went roaming in the wildwood like a ship that roams the sea.
The willow tree is fickle and it weeps in the morning dew. My love is a pine tree, and that's the only tree that's true.
If I was mistaken, then take my eyes away. You made a bed in the wildwood, and that's where I saw you lay.
Honey, your eyes deceived you. It's true, I touched the ground, but I never slept there. I never let my long hair down.
Tell us who you are.
Well, I'm Daniel Blino. I'm born and bred in South Africa. We moved here as a family in about 12 years ago. I'm an architect by profession. That's what I did most of my life. But I always, since a kid, what I really wanted to do, my first love really always has been art. My father convinced me that I need to take a sensible job. And he, one can understand, thought that architecture would be one, and for the most part it was. But a couple of years ago with the recession, you know, architecture became a problematic, it's a fantastic profession, but a problematic business. So I've been painting since a teenager. So I never stopped painting. I've always wanted to paint full time, and that's what I did.
This month on Sidewalk Radio,
right,
we're discussing trees. So it's a very happy coincidence that you happen to be in town and have an opening at the Bill Lowe Gallery on April 26th for your show, A Conversation with Trees.
You know, trees is a subject matter that I that was part of my painting career, you know, for the last 30 years. The reason I went back to trees is that, in a way, I wanted to portray not so much the physical sort of characteristics of a tree, not so much the realistic sort of representation of a tree, but I wanted to get down to the soul, and to the essence of a tree.
What is the soul of a tree?
You know, I'm sure that that many people will agree with me when I say that whenever you're in the presence of a majestic tree, like a 200-300-year-old tree, or a tall, big, old redwood, or just a major tree, you experience something that's more than just, this is not just a mere plant. This thing has personality, it has character, there's like a life force that I experience when I'm close to a tree. And in a way, I wanted to give my interpretation of what I experience when I'm close to big trees. I think trees are not the only sort of plant type that has that, but I think you know, a really big or a really old or a really sort of magnificent tree, they have you know, such presence, not quite a religious, but a spiritual experience. That's the word I'm looking for.
And so when you entitle this show, A Conversation with Trees, what is that conversation you're having, both literally and metaphorically?
Well, if to start with the metaphor, I think trees are wonderful metaphors for our human condition. If you look at the fact that they, you know, they have a life cycle, you know, from beginning to end, like we all as living beings. But in addition to that, they also have the cycle of seasons. And in a way, that's you know, very similar to our own life cycle. You know, they start with spring, and it's a happy sort of jubilant time, and then summer comes along, and then it's, you know, the bearing of fruit and procreation, and then it's the autumn years, and it's beautiful and glorious in its own way, and then it's the winter time where it's stark and harsh, but beautiful in a different way. And what I try to do in many of the work is to not necessarily paint an autumn tree or a spring tree, but rather to it's not a snapshot so much of a specific time, it's more a snapshot of a life cycle. So there will be a little bit of winter and a little bit of summer and a little bit of fall in the same painting.
Let's do this for the listener. I'll pick one of your works.
This is a painting. It's a painting where I've basically taken, again, three different seasons. The winter on the outside, a little bit of a checker pattern trunk. And then in the center of the painting, I have like a kaleidoscope of little blocks of mostly autumn and reddish and green, sort of olive green colors, and it stands on a landscape that's very vibrant in colors, purples and oranges and reds, and the intention is to create a painting that fills you with joy, you know. And what I scattered on the canvas in this instance were little pieces of found objects. What I do is when I paint, I always either clean my brushes on the, you know, one of the future canvases, or I spill a little bit of paint on it and I just don't care to wipe it up. And those blemishes actually become part of a future painting as what it's known in the art world as found objects. And I use it in some ways to show the imperfections of a tree. You know, even the most magnificent, glorious tree is full of warts and imperfections. And this painting has a few of those as well. And why I called it the art of being happy is that I think to some extent happiness is a choice. You know, we as people, regardless of our circumstances, can react to those in a more or less happy fashion. And, you know, I looked at this as a way to say to myself and maybe to the viewer, you know, just be happy, to quote
Bobby McFerrin.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry.
You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. I'd like to thank my guests today, Jenny Richardson, Greg Levine, artist Daniel Blineau, and the tree cowboy, Wayne Shannon. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will. Enjoy the beauty of spring, and see you next month.